Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Andras Tsifra, a political analyst and a fellow with the Eurasia program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's a regular contributor to FPRI's Bear Market Brief and the author of his own blog, No Yardstick. Thanks for joining me today, Andras.
Thank you for having me.
All right. It's great to have you on the show again. Now, clearly, the country that is by far the most affected by Russia's war against Ukraine is Ukraine. Russia is killing and wounding civilians every day, committing rights abuses, imprisoning people, occupying large swaths of territory in an independent foreign country. The war that Moscow provoked in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine started in 2014, and now it's been almost 17 months since Russia launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. But obviously the decision to launch this invasion has had and will continue to have a massive effect, many effects on Russia itself. Tens of thousands of Russian soldiers have been killed. The domestic crackdown on any form of dissent, particularly anti-war dissent, has grown even more intense. And there are major effects on the economy, the sanctions, not to mention the damage to Russia's international standing. I believe today is the ninth anniversary of the shooting down of MH17, the Malaysia Airlines passenger jet that was shot down by a Russian missile that was brought into Ukraine and then was returned to the system that fired the missile was then returned to Russia. That killed all 298 people on board that passenger plane in 2014. That's just to talk a little bit about the damage to Russia's international standing from what it's done. What I want to ask you about, Andras, is I guess the effects on politics and governance and planning in Russia. Earlier this year, you wrote a report for the Foreign Policy Research Institute titled "The War as an Accelerator." Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the war has accelerated some of the problems that I guess were caused by the Kremlin, by the Russian state in the first place, or at least have been exacerbated by policy. Now, one of the lines in your report that struck me was this: the invasion completely eliminated long-term policy planning and subordinated policymaking to war aims. Now, completely eliminated long-term policy planning. That's a quote. That's quite a statement. And I imagine the situation has been exacerbated by the fact that the invasion has not gone at all as President Vladimir Putin expected it to. By all accounts, he expected to subjugate Ukraine within days or at most weeks. Since this did not happen, and the war is still raging almost a year and a half later, sounds like maybe Putin and the Kremlin are just winging it. Anyway, Andras, I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on how Russia's invasion of Ukraine has affected policy planning and what some of the consequences might be.
Yeah, so it's exactly what you said is what I meant with the war being an accelerator. So if I were to give you a very short summary of what the report is saying, it's that the war changed everything. Nothing changed in Russia, so the war changed everything in the sense that it accelerated existing problems that prior to the 2022 invasion, because obviously when we speak about the war started in 2014. So prior to the 2022 invasion seemed to be potentially manageable. What we were seeing prior to 2022 is a personalist autocracy in Russia with a short-term time horizon, planning horizon, which was 2024, the year when Putin's current presidential term runs out, trying to sort of make peace between the often conflicting short-termism of its sort of propelled by its autocratic instinct and goals, and the aim to make the system built by Vladimir Putin and his, let's say, team, fairly diverse team of both technocrats, bureaucrats, kleptocrats, and what have you, over the past 20 years, maybe run itself a little better. Now, one of the dilemmas that that were visible in 2021, early 2022, was whether this sort of this will be resolved, this contradiction will be resolved in the form of grand development project built on the sort of the post-pandemic recovery or something else. And of course, now we know the answer. The answer was something else. This disastrous invasion in 2022, which basically rendered all prior plans very difficult to maintain. And when I say that the war has completely eliminated short-term policy planning, long-term policy planning, what I mean is that it turbocharged this sort of short-termism that was there in the system, that was conflicting with making long-term policies that pay out in time horizons that are that are too much in the future for a personalist autocracy, even prior to 2022. But now, due to the uncertainties that the war, the horizon of the war, the shifting horizon of the war, and the shifting costs that the war has brought to Russia, mean it has become almost impossible to even pretend that these plans are still there, that they are still being seriously analyzed and seriously implemented. So one thing that we have seen is obviously on the federal level is the budget for the war allocations for war purposes, military expenses in the federal budget ballooning, not just over the past, not just over 2022, but especially also, and I would say especially in 2023, we have a ballooning federal deficit. And this has led to cuts in other expenses, primarily expenses on state-driven investment projects, which due to a drying up of private investment now constitute the backbone of the development projects that Russia now has to sort of accelerate due to the drying up of its export markets, its traditional export markets in Western Europe, its sort of forced pivot to the east. And the gist of the report was to was describing on the example of the policy planning that has taken place over the past year and a half in the Russian government, how this is really just technocrats, able as they might be, managing a crisis, but not really planning, not really taking part in making the strategic decisions that would sort of change the course that Russia is on. So this is what we see now, is mostly crisis management. It's not really Russia trying to find its way out of this crisis. What happened to the time horizons is that for a long time, the months after the 2022 invasion started, and when it became obvious that it was not going according to plans, there was still a sense in Russia that eventually, before the country sort of incurs unavoidable costs, unavoidable large costs due to its decoupling from the global economy, or the part, not the complete global economy, of course, but the global economy toward the part of the global economy towards which Russia's economy itself had been oriented traditionally. That before this happens, Ukraine will crumble, or the West support behind Ukraine will crumble. And you only need to wait for just a little bit more, and everything will be back to business as usual, or if not business as usual, but at least better than currently. So the whole policymaking in 2022, in most of 2022, was built on this sort of gamble, on the beliefs of the political, the high political elite, and perhaps the security elite, that the war was was inevitable, and that victory was just around the corner. Now, as long as you know enough people accept that these assumptions are true, the situation is manageable. It's not good, but it's manageable because people will sort of buy in. The problem starts when these costs started becoming unavoidable. When exporters at the end of the year in several industries that were typically Europe-oriented, metallurgy, timber, obviously the gas industry, which was not sanctioned, but which sort of Russia itself turned off most of it towards Europe, faced a potentially irredeemable loss of its export markets. When it became obvious that capacities in the eastern direction were overloaded and it would have to be scaled up very quickly, or alternatives would have to be found, and the costs, the short-term costs of this pivot became obvious, and we are still in this phase as of mid 2023. So. What did the Russian government do that sort of, to me, epitomized this lack of or abandonment of long-term policy planning? Well, one of the, I think, the most blatant examples of this was the so-called war tax, as it is known in Russian political parlance, which is a tax on extra profits. Technically, that's the name. Which we now know the story from various journalistic reporting that was just proposed to the idea was proposed or imposed upon the Russian business elite. The government needed 300 billion rubles, and the business elite was told to come up with this kind of money. Or how the Russian government revamped the taxation of oil exports as a response to the G7 oil embargo, how they sort of abandoned the benchmark price that they used to calculate taxes before, and just started using an arbitrary rising scale of prices to which they sort of based on which they calculated the taxes for their budget over the past months. And it didn't really work out either, because federal budget's incomes from energy sales collapsed nonetheless, or were at least significantly lower. There are all these like very loud debates between various industries that are trying to sort of use these limited export transit capacities in the eastern direction. There are loud debates about who will finance the expansion of eastern railway lines, for instance, or the electrification of the existing lines. which state companies like Russian Railways does not have the does not quite have the money to perform according to plan or according to these now accelerated plans, whether tariffs will need to be raised. So this is, I could come up with five other examples, from, you know, fisheries to car making, which was probably one of the industries most impacted by the sanctions in the early stage. But you get the point. Basically, this is a very, very messy crisis management. The system that Russia is governed in was not designed, or at least it hasn't reached the stage of evolution that is able to handle so many conflicting crises, especially when one kind of spending, military spending and spending on domestic security, is so prioritized. We hear about, just a couple of weeks ago, the finance minister reportedly came up with plans to sequester 10% of the so-called non-protected items of the federal budget in 2024. That means that money for these investments, for these grand investment projects, will be further limited at a time when they are very needed, and they are not. There are no alternatives on the horizon that we can see that would sort of fill this gap. We see how the Russian government is really trying to lure, for instance, Chinese investment, Chinese money into some of these projects. But China has been very selective. It is not really investing in projects that the Russian government would like them to. It hasn't agreed with Russia, for instance, on the second Power of Siberia gas pipeline. But also, apart from Chinese car makers or taking over parts of the ailing Russian car industry over the past year, and apart from talks about certain railways that would basically transport raw material from Russia to China over a certain period of time in the future, not in the next 1 or 2 years, but in a longer time horizon, there hasn't really been anything worth mentioning in this field. So Russia is still in the situation where the economy is working. It is due to the enormous amounts of money that have been poured into industries connected to, or the military spending, and by extension, industries connected to the military spending, can produce numbers that suggest that the economy is okay, but it's really not okay, and it does not have the necessary sort of policy planning institutions that would be needed to significantly change the situation that the economy and key industries are facing.
All right, thanks very much, Andash. I like the phrase that you spoke. I think bureaucrats, technocrats, and kleptocrats, and some great examples there of I guess the way the government is trying to get money for the war, including, I believe you mentioned, sort of raising oil export taxes in an arbitrary fashion, but that didn't work anyway. So thanks very much for that. My second question is related to the first. In the same report for FPRI, you also wrote that, quote, these problems are causing frictions and elevating domestic political risks for the Kremlin, unquote. So I'd be grateful if you could talk about these frictions and these risks. And a somewhat specific related question, has the mutiny late last month by Yevgeny Prigozhin and his Wagner forces had additional effects? Has it kind of exacerbated the existing risks, I guess, for the Kremlin?
I see you started by mentioning the most obvious risk that we have seen over the past month, so I can't mention that, the mutiny. But of course, that I think signaled one of the major problems that the Kremlin has now on its hands with how the invasion is going. It's like, I think, to me, you know, when the mutiny started in late June 24th, as I was following, as we all did, I think, with astonishment, the news of Prigozhin's sort of Wagner column going first to Rostov and then Voronezh and then all the way almost to the outskirts of Moscow. What really stood out to me was how long everyone decided that this was someone else's problem and they did not have to deal with it, or so it seemed, at least from the sidelines. And I think this didn't surprise me, because this, I believe, is characteristic for the broader governance system in this sort of very top-down responsibility structure that has crystallized in Russia over the past years. So, well, for instance, one of the if I can draw a parallel here, one of the things that we have seen over the past year and a half is the emergence yet again of this very peculiar Russian crisis management system, which we had seen already during the pandemic, that decisions are outsourced, or at least not decisions, but political responsibility for decisions are outsourced to governors. In the pandemic, this was lockdowns, right? Like, if you remember, governors were given the power to order lockdowns to sort of themselves to ensure that the economy was running and that people did not take to the streets in dissatisfaction, and that the local healthcare system didn't collapse. So they had to sort of juggle these priorities. But what this meant was basically, like, in practice, governors still were looking for cues from either the Kremlin or from bigger regions like Moscow, which, you know, itself sort of played a massive role in policymaking or in signaling policymaking during the pandemic, on what to do. What basically they have to do is to understand local sensitivities and sort of try not to push too hard when they couldn't, but otherwise just follow these cues and take responsibility for what was essentially decided in the center. And then we saw the same during the vaccination campaign of 2021. And in the war, the Kremlin tried to do a remarkably similar system, even with, you know, similar institutions to coordinate regions, by first asking regions to sort of oversee military mobilization, which was a very unpopular policy back in September 2022. And then in October, when Putin issued decrees on these various stages of what is de facto military law or martial law, regions were told who fell under these decrees to sort of set up operational headquarters to oversee various things in their in their territory, including that the military's needs were met. And these operational headquarters were essentially institutions that were dominated as much by the local security elite as by the governors. And they were, again, looking for cues from the center. They were, a lot of them, for instance, took decisions to ban drones, even regions that absolutely faced no drone attacks over the past months. And similar other it took similar other decisions that sort of happened in succession when one took them and one big region took them, then suddenly a lot of others did. And I think when we look at the Wagner mutiny, what we saw was that for a very long time, regions, along with the sort of the security establishment in the regions, didn't really do anything. And regions started to, or regional leaders started to signal loyalty to the Kremlin with, like, sometimes using very muted language even then. When apparently, at least this is what we have read reports about, when they got a phone call from the center, from the federal center. Now, I don't know whether this is exactly what happened, but what I do know is that for hours, nothing happened, and then regions started to sort of put out very similar looking messages that signaled loyalty. And then after the mutiny, some regions started signaling their loyalty even more than that. Like, where we have the governor of the Kursk region who said that, we would have dealt with these mutineers if they had been in our region. Well, you know, that's an easy thing to say after the mutiny had been essentially, if not put down, but at least repelled. Or their banners went up in the Rostov region that signaled loyalty to the federal center. So I believe this was this in a way signaled how the federal government, how regions are trying to sort of curry favors from the federal government, or how they are administered, to what extent the regional governments are independent or autonomous administrators of their regions. Not very much. But if we don't talk about the Wagner mutiny for a moment, what I see as a risk, as an elevated risk, is that regional governments are or have been asked to do a lot of things. They are overseeing military mobilization, or we're overseeing military mobilization, in many cases covert mobilization to this day. They need to make sure that their local economies are surviving, that they are that you know, there are enough jobs, that there are enough products in the stores, for instance, or there is no sudden breakdown of labor relations in a big industrial city, for instance. They have also been asked, especially in regions that are on the way along these expanding export routes towards Asia, to sort of forecast more money to on infrastructure projects. One of the latest initiatives is the tax break that would basically take money away from regions by giving tax breaks to companies. Company income taxes are one of the main sources of regional budgets. So would give tax breaks to companies that invest in priorities set by the federal government. So again, like regional budgets are that were not really affected negatively, at least in the first half of 2022, more so in the second half, but they had enough reserves. We'll have to fork out more money on these, or we'll be expected to in 2023. And at the same time, they have to, you know, juggle all these often conflicting priorities. The one clear priority is the war. And then at the same time, we face an immutability of regional leadership. The Kremlin has taken a very careful approach to this over the past year and a half. There were very few dismissals in the regions, probably in order to reduce risks. But this is, but at the same time, they've been trying to sort of end certain power sharing deals with regional elites in some regions, for instance, in Novosibirsk, which had a kind of power sharing deal with between the United Russia governor and the local Communist Party that gave the head of Novosibirsk the regional capital, and that was scrapped by United Russia. Essentially scrapping direct mayoral elections. So, and this is just one example. There are several other such little power-sharing deals that have been pushed back over the past year, again, probably also to reduce risks in the regions. So when you are trying to sort of push back against these power-sharing deals, when you are trying to minimize risks by saying everyone stay put, stay quiet, I think inevitably the risks of and perhaps counterintuitively from an authoritarian's point of view, the risks of something happening, something small happening that balloons into something bigger grow, because there is less money that has to be spent on significantly more priorities. There are sort of these overstretched bureaucracies in the regions that don't really have power. They get distracted, or they just don't dare to act in a case where they should be acting, where an autonomous bottom up bureaucracy would be acting. There is the lack of money that is basically being reallocated from these development projects, national projects that that will be missing from some people's purses. So there are just an enormous amount of risk factors, as far as I can see, that potentially can balloon to something bigger. Now, this can take the form of regional elites organizing, sort of co-opting some kind of local cause to put pressure on the government, to the federal government, to send more money. There are, the contours of this are emerging in some regions. So, for instance, around direct mayoral elections, but also there have been other regions that have been signaling to the Kremlin over the past months that, hey, we don't have enough money. The sort of the tax calculation system that prioritizes the liquidity of the federal budget, perhaps that puts regions at a worse place and it need to be changed or repealed. This is a new system that was put in place at the beginning of this year. Are these comparable to the big sort of regional, almost like the parade of sovereignties, as it was called in the beginning of the 1990s? No, I don't think so. They are still, at this point, they are still a far cry from that. But they take place in from many aspects significantly more pessimistic and uncertain time, when it is becoming increasingly uncertain that Russia is going to emerge from this conflict stronger. And or that the war will be over with an outcome that is favorable or at least not disastrous for Russia in the near term. So I think this changes the conversation a little bit. And while I wouldn't be able to point at one specific issue and tell you this is going to bring down Putin's regime or this is going to cause big problems, there are so many of these potential issues that I think that itself is worth acknowledging, that is exactly one of the main purposes of sanctions. One of my Russia analyst colleagues, Yanis Kluge from SWP in Berlin, don't want to steal his metaphor, but I just want to mention it because I liked it so much. Said sanctions in this case are a bit like shaking a tree. and you don't see the tree, you don't see what's inside the tree, but something will fall. And that's exactly, I think, what is happening, or what will be happening, what we'll see in the next couple of months.
Well, thanks very much, Anders. That's fascinating. It's a great detail there. I wonder, you mentioned, this is just sort of a comment, you mentioned that this is all taking place in a time of great uncertainty, you know, in Russia, and including about whether the war will leave Russia better off or perhaps much worse off. And I wonder whether the narrative that Putin has been really hitting hard lately actually exacerbates that. I'm talking about the narrative of, you know, the West is essentially out to destroy Russia. You know, if you're told that, and then you can also perhaps see that Russia's not winning the war, I would think that might add to your concerns as opposed to alleviating them. But we're getting short on time, but I'd like to ask, I'd like to take a few questions if there are any. So we'll just give it a few moments to see if anyone has questions. So far, none. I'm going to ask one myself. It's sort of again about Prigozhin, but also the election. Now there are a few elections in September, but then of course, presidential election should be held in March 2024. And I just saw an article from Bloomberg today that was talking about how the costs that the insecurity or the feeling of the lack of security in the Kremlin, you know, due to the mutiny, is going to cause, you know, will require extra expenditures. And particularly, you know, ahead of the election, when Putin is concerned about getting, having the election look good, and presumably being reelected, though he hasn't announced whether he's running. I think it's widely assumed that he will. And I think they gave a figure, like, I don't want to pin you down and trying to you know, guess numbers or predict numbers, but I think the figure was something like, would add 5% to, you know, to budget expenditures. I mean, do you see anything like that happening, kind of as a direct result of the mutiny? Just the idea of extra security, other concerns adding to the what I think you described as, you know, kind of competing, I guess, programs or motives for spending money.
Yeah, so, how a system like this manages elections, obviously, first and foremost, presidential elections, which is the most important, but also other elections. We're talking about elections in several Russian regions in September this year, is always a mix of coercion and goodies, or let's say more subtle pressure. But also, when I use the expression more subtle pressure, I mean payouts to the right people. And one of the things that has been actually baffling to me is how various officials over the past weeks have been pushing for a very quick reduction of budgetary expenses over as soon as the next year. You know, there are some who said that we only need to sequester part of the budget in 2025. Others said that already 2024 will be a sort of a lean year, and that's not something that you hear very often before an election year. And that would suggest to me that the thinking in the Kremlin is that instead of sort of these positive incentives or positive pressure, positive nudge to the population or to the key actors who will eventually bring enough people, the right people, to the right polls, be they public officials or company leaders. So instead of this kind of so-called positive nudges, they are going to rely significantly more on other sort of more sinister tools to ensure that they get the results that they want. And yes, one of this is obviously coercion and ramping up security expenditures would be just a natural reaction of a paranoid and increasingly paranoid autocracy at this point after a mutiny. I wouldn't be surprised at all about that. But I think the whole system is sort of lurching towards the security angle of this sort of balance over that we have seen over the past years. One of the things that the Kremlin is planning to roll out, for instance, you know, over the course of the September elections and also in 2024, is the so-called online. Well, what is referred to colloquially as online voting. It's like a distanced electronic voting is the official name, which we have seen, of which we have seen the effects in Moscow, for instance, in the 2021 Duma election, when electronic voting was used, or electronic voting results sort of overturned what seemed to be stable opposition wins in the capital. And the way it happened was so opaque, but also somehow so difficult to analyze and dissect and show to the population how whether it was just an anomaly or what many suspected, and then some analyses actually proved was closer to falsification. That ultimately, it did not really change much. So I believe we are going to see more of such coercion as well. And this perhaps, the ability to extend these sort of this kind of electoral engineering on more regions, be it this online voting or be it the multi-day voting that they introduced during the pandemic, sort of gives the impression to political technologists in the Kremlin that this, coupled with the sort of tighter security or more crackdown on the ground, can do the trick that they in the past had to use positive incentives or positive nudges for. Whether that's going to be the case, we don't know. I think from this perspective, the 2023 September regional elections will be very educational because, unlike in 2022, in 2023, we will actually see some elections in regions that have a more pluralistic politics, even today, even now. So there are a couple of interesting electoral campaigns shaping up in, for instance, the far right, the far eastern maritime territory, and also in Caucasia, but elsewhere too. So it will be educational for us. It will probably also be educational for the Kremlin, and I would probably start talking about what is going to happen or what is likely to happen in 2024 after these elections in September.
Yeah, thanks, Andras. Yeah, that'll be quite interesting to watch those elections. And I guess they're also going to be, and you mentioned some regions where it could be particularly kind of telling. And I guess they're also going to hold elections in the parts of Ukraine that Russia occupies. So that's,
yes,
much of the focus will be on that. you know, these kind of sham elections in those regions. All right. Thanks very much for that additional analysis. See if there's if any questions have come in. And if not, I do not see any for now. So just 1 second. Okay, we do have a question from Martin Zeilig. So we can, Martin, if you can, I'm not sure whether you've requested speaker privilege, but you can go ahead. Martin, please go ahead. So I see you, your mic is off right now, Martin, if you want to ask.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that, Steve. Martin Zeilig in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. I tuned in late, so I'm not sure if you mentioned this at the outset of the show, but I received, just as a reminder, and of course as a fellow journalist, which we both are, Evan Gerskovich, there was a media release from the United Nations Human Rights Special Procedures today called Gerskovich's Arbitrary Detention is an Attack Against Independent Journalism, say UN experts, and they called for, I'm quoting, the immediate release of Mr. Gerskovich, a journalist who was arbitrarily arrested by the Russian Federal Security Service on 29th March 2023 and has since been held for over 100 days in pretrial detention at Lefortovo prison in Moscow. If you'll just allow me a moment. The arrest and indictment of Mr. Gerskovich on serious criminal charges, which could lead to 20 years in a penal colony, is an example of the severe clampdown on freedom of opinion and expression and on independent journalism in Russia since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine 17 months ago, the experts said. Anyways, it goes on, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention, and it also says that, and thank you for allowing me this, Steve, the experts noted that Lefortovo District Court in Moscow extended Mr. Gerskovich's detention until the 30th of August 2023 in a private hearing held on 23rd of May. His subsequent appeal of the detention measure was rejected. To date, he has only been allowed 2 consular visits despite numerous requests for access from the U.S. ambassador to Russia. Russian authorities explained their refusal of a response to the, quote, U.S. denial of visas to Russian journalists. And it goes on. So I just wanted to bring that once again, that to everybody's attention. And we should always keep Mr. Gerskovich in our mind. And as one more example of the repression in the terrorist regime of Russia. So thank you for allowing me to speak. And I enjoy your show.
All right. Thank you, Martin. Yes. I mean, I mentioned at the beginning, I think, you know, that this invasion of Ukraine is affecting mostly Ukraine more than any other country, certainly. But that the effects on Russia are gigantic, including the clampdown, which in this case, you know, as you rightly point out, is unfortunately affecting, you know, someone who, a journalist. Obviously, it affects many Russian journalists, but in this case, it's affecting a journalist who's not from Russia. And Gerskovich, Evan Gerskovich, I believe, is the first journalist to be charged with espionage since the Soviet collapse in Russia. So, you know, obviously, it is a big part of this of what's happening, of the clamp down in a way isn't the right word because it might suggest some kind of wrongdoing. But you know, obviously a big part of what the Russian state is doing in terms of repression and cracking down on all forms of not just dissent, but any kind of, you know, but journalism as well, attempts, and civil society attempts to tell the truth, to get information. So thanks for that, Martin. And we are out of time, so I'm going to wrap it up here. And, you know, just wanted to say, Andras, great insights, and thanks very much for joining me at this time.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Andras Tatsifra, a political analyst and a fellow with the Eurasia Program of the Foreign Policy Research Institute, or FPRI. He's a regular contributor to the Bear Market Brief and the author of his own blog, No Yardstick. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFURL. As I mentioned, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFURL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, and other podcast platforms. I'll be back for another installment of The Week Ahead in Russia next Monday, and please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which comes out most Fridays. Thanks for listening.